let's go ahead and get started. So today we're going to finish talking. Today, can you hear me? Let's see. Okay, so today we're going to finish talking about linear regression. So last time we talked about how what the linear model was. Did that do anything? Yeah. Okay, I think we need to basically complain. No, that doesn't do anything either. Okay. Okay, so this is, I think this is just the way it's going to be. Oh, maybe there's something here. It doesn't sound like that's doing anything, but yeah, I already tried the mute thing. Well, there's a mute button on here, on the top of it.
Mute. How's that? Oh! Okay, turn this down a bit. Does this
mute button? Yep, that does mute.
Okay, good. That's good. It's always nice to have mute buttons hidden all over the room, so that, okay. Okay, right, so we started by talking about the linear model, and we talked about how we would estimate the parameters of the model by minimizing, by minimizing this squared error here. And we saw that this is that this is usually a nice quadratic function, and that we can, and that we have this equation here to minimize it. And so now I want to talk about some issues with the linear model and some ways that we can extend it. So one issue with the linear model is that this is actually an issue with the least squares estimation technique, is that it can be very sensitive to outliers. So here's an example. So what I did is I did linear regression on 6 data points with one up here. So this is the input, this is the output. If I and I generated this from this curve here, and then I added this one outlier. So the real curve is this green line here. And you see it does a pretty good job of fitting the 5 data points that I generated from it. But as soon as I added this one outlier up here, what happens is the best linear regression line changes from this green line all the way up to this red line. So that's something that you want to be careful about when you're applying linear regression in practice. And you can actually see this, if you want to plot this, by looking at the residuals of the regression. So if you plot had the x-axis being your input, and if the y-axis you look for data points that have a large residual to the regression line, that's one way that you can spot outliers like this. You'll remember that we said something similar about the mean of a distribution being, about the maximum likelihood estimator of the mean of a distribution being sensitive to outliers. And linear regression has the same property, and it turns out that it's actually for the same reason. And we won't, I won't actually get into why that is, but if you think about, I won't get into why that is. But it is actually, if you go a bit deeper, you can see it actually is the same reason. So that leads to the issue of, what can I do to diagnose whether a linear regression model is having this problem or not? So one kind of problem we talked about is the outliers. Another kind of problem that you can have is if the relationship's obviously nonlinear. Right, so if you want to, you might want a way to decide, do I want to add quadratic or higher order features to get a better regression model? So it's nice to have graphical methods in order to find some obvious problems with the linear regression model. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there are kind of certain standard diagnostic plots that you can do, which have to do with plotting the outliers of the model. So lots of times the stats packages will do this for you. So they'll bring up and show a plot of, for example, one plot that they'll show you will be, say, the outliers as a function of the fitted values. So what they'll show you is the y value on this red line as opposed to the actual y value. And you can look at plots like that to see if there's any kind of obvious structure in the residuals. So that can be a good thing to do. So now that we've talked about that, let's start talking about some ways to extend the simple linear regression model. One way is you might want to predict multiple outputs rather than a single output. So rather than saying just having one real valued number that you want to predict given each input, maybe there are q real valued numbers. For example, maybe I want to predict both height and weight. So the simplest way to do this is to train them all independently. So I'll just treat them as q separate regression problems, and I'll have a separate set of weights for each regression problem. And then run the regressions independently. So just pretend that I had q separate regression problems, and that's called multiple regression. And that's the simplest way to handle that. If you think the things you want to predict are actually correlated, so maybe you're trying to predict a person's height and weight based on their age and their country of residence and other things like that, if you think those two values are correlated, then it gets a bit more complicated. You actually get into some of the graphical models that are talked about in PMR, and we're not going to go into that in this course. Okay, so now let's talk about, I made this point when we first started talking about linear models, that they seem really, really kind of simple and stupid, like the first thing you could do for regression, but it turns out they're more powerful than you think. And the reason that they're more powerful than you think is because of basis expansion. So what I mean by that is a linear model, it doesn't have to be linear in the inputs for all of this stuff we've done to work. It just has to be linear in the parameters. So what we can do, this trick we can do, is we'll take this original input x that we got, and we'll transform it through some nonlinear function phi. So we'll transform it into a higher dimensional space, so that phi of x will have more features, and will have more dimensions, potentially, than x does. And what that will do is it will allow the regression to represent a nonlinear surface in X space, but the fitting technology will just be the simpler linear fit that we already know how to do. So the simplest example of a nonlinear fit would be to use polynomial functions. So rather than your input just being X, you could add X squared, X cubed, and so on. But there are other, so that can be a good thing to do, but there are other more complicated things you could do as well. So what you might do, so what each of these plots are, is this is the original feature value, and this is the transformed feature value. So this would be kind of a simple polynomial that we've already talked about a bit. And I think I have an example of this in the next slide, but you can also do more complicated transformations. So what you might do is take the feature value, so this is the original feature that I'm trying to predict on, and I might put it through a Gaussian function. So I might say, if my feature value used to be 0.75, I'll put it through this blue Gaussian PDF and get, 0.6 or something like that. And I could have a number of Gaussians with different means. So that will lead to radial basis functions, which I'll talk about in more detail in a couple of slides. Another thing I might do is I might want to kind of discretize the input. So I might want to say, well, maybe if I'm over 0.5, I want the regression to do something very different than if it's under 0.5. So one thing I could do is I could add a feature that says it's 1 if I'm above this threshold and 0 if I'm below. That could be a good thing to do. But I could also have a soft threshold. And that's what these sigmoid functions are. So each of these colored lines is a different example of a sigmoid function with a different parameter. And next lecture, we'll see the sigmoid function in more detail. And we'll see what the equation for it is and why you might want to use it. But for now, all you have to know is that it asymptotes to 0, and then it goes up to 1. So it's just a smooth function that looks like this. So what this is a way of doing is giving you a smooth version of just the idea of a thresholding idea of saying, so this is a smoother way to say, give me a 1 if I'm above 0.5 or a 0 if I'm below. So that's a way, so that gives you kind of soft features like that. Now suppose that I'll go through a couple of these in more detail, but first, how would you come up with the weights for this kind of model? Well, so the way you do fitting is you start just as before. So each of these phis, I'm going to say that now they output, now I'm going to say the output is an m-dimensional vector. So this thing phi of x is going to be m dimensions. And so I create a matrix as before, where each row corresponds to a training example. And now each column is going to correspond to one dimension of phi of x. So now that I have this matrix capital phi, and I have my outputs y1 through yn as before, I'm going to turn the same crank that I did for regular linear regression. So I'm going to say, well, define this squared error function, which I'm going to want to minimize. And now this is going to be, as before, have one weight for each feature in the transformed space. So now W will be a feature vector. W will be a weight vector with dimension m. And I'm going to try to minimize. So as before, phi, the matrix phi times W will give me the predictions for all the examples. And I'll subtract this from, and I'll try to minimize the squared difference to my true set of outputs. So this is the function I want to minimize. And just as before, I can take the derivative, set it to 0, and solve for the value w hat that would have a derivative of 0. And what I get is the same thing as I had before. I get the pseudo inverse of phi transpose phi inverse times phi transpose. So everything really works as before. And in fact, if you have a software package for doing linear regression, all you would have to do is lie to your software package in order to get it to do this kind of regression with basis expansion. You know, just tell it that your inputs were phi of x rather than x, and you're fine. So here's how that would work if I wanted to do polynomial regression. The true regression function is going to be this green thing, this green sinusoid thing. And the data points I'll observe that have some noise are going to be these blue points here. And let's see what happens when we try to do polynomial regression with an increasing order, so with increasing number of regression coefficients. And I'll use big M to refer to the highest order feature in the regression. So if M equals 0, then the only way I get is 1. So what's going to happen when I run regression with just the feature 1? What's going to happen? What's going to be that corresponding weight? Yeah, it's just going to be the mean. So I'm going to get a straight line of the mean. I don't have any features that depend on x. And if you want to convince yourself of that, all you have to do is figure out what this thing is going to be. Each of these things are just one-dimensional, and they're all going to be 1. So what I get is w hat is going to be, so this thing is going to be a vector of all 1s transpose y, which is going to give you an average. Okay, so and now if I allow linear regression, then if I have m equals 1, that's just standard linear regression. So I'll get some line like this, which you can see if I didn't tell you about that green line, it kind of fits the points. But you see there's a kind of a pattern here, that points above over here tend to be above the regression line, and points over here tend to be below. So we could do a little bit better at fitting the data. And in fact, if we set m equals 3 so that we allow cubic features, then we get this thing that more or less fits the data. So okay, that's pretty good. So let's turn up m. If this was a pretty good fit to the training data, but let's get it really, really good. So let's set m all the way to 9. I guess I should have set it to I guess this was Chris Bishop didn't feel like referencing Spinal Tap, so he didn't set it all the way to 11. But if I set it to 9, where I have 9 data points, what happens is I go through every single data point. That makes sense if you remember from algebra that given a given m points, that uniquely any set of m points uniquely defines a polynomial of order m. So there's only one polynomial there, so there is a polynomial that exactly goes through all of these data points, but outside the data points, it has to do something really crazy in order to be able to hit the next one. So even if I didn't show you this green line, if I just showed you these blue points, I think you'd probably say, you know, if I there's no way you'd draw this curve in order to hit those blue points. So allowing the model too much freedom. So what the model is doing in this sense is it's essentially memorizing the training data, and it doesn't care at all what happens as soon as it moves away from the training points, and that's not good. So what that means is don't set your M all the way to 11. So that's a basic expansion. There can be other simple things you can do to transform the features that are important. So remember from last lecture, I talked about an example where we were using linear regression to predict the performance of a particular of a CPU, given some features about the design of its architecture. So maybe one of the features is the manufacturer. Maybe Intel CPUs just happen to be better than Motorola CPUs with the same specs. I don't know if that's true or not, but you know, we could look at the data and try to find out. So I might say, well, you know what, I'll code the manufacturer has a feature for the linear regression. I'll say one if it's Intel, three if it's Apple, and so on. You think this is a good idea? Yeah?
It's not because the data is categorical rather than numerical.
Yeah, exactly. So what I don't expect, even if Apple's better than Intel, I don't expect it to be three times better or worse than Intel, right? So some being linear in this thing doesn't really have any meaning. So what could I do instead? Yeah? So you could do exactly that. Have four features that are 0 to 1 that say, am I Intel, am I not? So what the weight on this feature is going to do is it's just going to give me add a constant plus or minus to my prediction of y, depending on if it's Intel or not. So I'll get a different baseline level for each manufacturer. So that's an example of transforming the features in order to make the relationship more linear. There are other ways you might want to transform the features to do that. So for example, you might want to take a log, or you might want to square one of the features that we've seen before. Sometimes taking a square root can be a good idea. So those are things you might look at if you think the relationship isn't really linear. Okay, so now we started with basis expansions, and then we said, we looked at kind of a polynomial basis expansion, and then we said, this thing here is maybe a poor man's basis expansion. So now let's do something really complex. So the more complex thing we're going to do is called a radial basis function model. So this corresponds to that Gaussian example that I showed you a couple of slides ago when we looked at polynomial Gaussian or sigmoid. This is the feature function that we use if we want to have Gaussians. So for each one of these, so we're going to define a set of new features, say 1 through m. For each one of these features, phi I is going to be based on a Gaussian with some center that I have to pick. Maybe I might put them at the training points. That's one popular choice. But in practice, I could put them wherever I want. And some standard deviation, which is going to be, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So this is essentially an unnormalized PDF of a Gaussian. Remember, a Gaussian is just e to the minus x squared, and that's what this is. And so what the idea behind what this does is each of the features kind of specializes in a particular portion of the input space. So it's kind of like having a feature that says, my feature function of x is going to be, is x near c or not? So you can imagine saying, 0, 1, so one kind of, really sharp feature you could imagine would be to say 0, 1, is x near ci, right? Is x within radius 1 of ci? So what this gives you is a softer way of doing that. So in order to use this, you have to pick these c's and these alphas. Once you've fixed those, then it's easy to fit the weights of the regression model, because you just do the kind of pseudo inverse least squares fittings before. So the new hard part with RBFs is, well, usually choosing C is kind of okay, right? You could just choose a subset of the data points. Choosing alpha tends to be really, really tricky. Actually, there's one thing I'm going to talk about later in this lecture that might work. But for now, I'm not really going to tell you anything about how to choose alpha. So let's just go through an example to see why you might want to do radial basis functions. So this is again an example of a relationship that's nonlinear. This is the input and this is the output. I'm putting each of the data points in a different shape for a reason you'll see in a moment. If I try to do linear regression on this, it's not really going to work very well, right? I mean, this is clearly not linear. So what I might do instead is I might define two radial basis functions as features. One of them I'm going to center over here, and one of them I'm going to center over here. And you see these both have the same standard deviation alpha. I don't remember what it was. I think it was probably one, but I don't remember. You can look at it and guess. So now let's see what the data set looks like when I transform it through each of these features. So if I transform it through, it is one. I actually did tell you. So if I transform it through the first feature, what you see is things that are close to the center of this point, the center was 3. Things that are close to this are going to have they're going to have very high feature values because the Gaussian PDF was very high here. So around here, this now looks like a linear feature near the center. And these things that are very far away from the center, they all kind of get mapped to 0 because that's what the Gaussian does in the tails. So what this feature says is you want to be, it's in this region, I'm going to be linear. And then in this region, I'm not going to tell you anything about what to do. This feature isn't useful for discriminating these examples. And the second RBF feature is going to do the opposite. What it's going to do is it's going to say something that's kind of linear. This I centered over here, right? So it's going to give you, this feature is going to be very good for discriminating these two examples. And as far as these two, that's just mapping them all to 0. And so, so now let's see what happens when we, so I can do linear regression with those two features. The problem is that gives me, once I add the one feature, that gives me 3 features and 1 output. I can't show that on the slide. So what I'm going to show you instead are the residuals. So these are the data points in the original space. This was my original data. What this is are the residuals after I did this fitting with those two residual radial basis function features that I showed you before. And what you see is they actually do a really good job of fitting this data. And they ought to. Can you guess why? I just generated the example from those features so that it would work out. So that's an example where they work really well, but it's not a panacea. So you think, if I had enough radial basis functions, I could fit any function I want, which it turns out that's true. So why not just use them for every kind of regression problem? And the answer is, it depends on how many radial basis functions you have. If I have a function that's very wiggly and that's very complicated, then I'm going to need a lot of basis functions in order to fit it, and I'll be in a similar situation that I was with the polynomial with m equals 9, right? That I'll get some kind of really wiggly function that fits the training data really well, and isn't good for anything outside the training set. So an extreme example would be, let's say I centered an RBF on every single point with a very, very, very small standard deviation. So I'll make the standard deviation 0.001 for all of them, and I'll center one on each training point. Then what the weights let you do is just actually remember what the training inputs were, right? Because there's only one training point on which each feature fires. So you're going to memorize the training data and learn nothing if you did that. So it can be a bit of a black art to actually kind of set these by hand for regression problems, but it's still a very useful method to know about. And actually, we will be using radial basis functions again later in the course for one of the best classifiers that we have, which are called support vector machines. Okay, so that is that finishes up what I had to say about linear regression. Whenever you're applying machine learning, you always want to use the simplest method that you can get away with. So you always want to try linear regression before trying something else that's more complicated. And the key thing to remember about linear regression, the reason that it's more powerful than you might think, is that linear regression means linear in the parameters. So you can have a transformation that's non-linear in the input, that's linear in the parameters, and then you can still use these tricks. But if you do that too much, you have this danger of overfitting, which is what I'm going to talk about next. So do we have any questions about linear regression or anything else? Anything else I've said so far? Yeah. I'm not sure what you mean. Sorry. Oh, W. Those things, W. Those are the parameters. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, good. So let me go on and start talking about overfitting, because that's one of that. This one, yeah, because that's one of the. That's really one of the key conceptions. Oh, you've already seen this one before. Let's see if that works. That's really one of the key conceptual problems that we have to deal with when we're talking about machine learning. So the first question is, like, what do I mean when I'm talking about overfitting? So any kind of predictor that I learn from data, so for example, we're gonna call it, say, like FD is what we're gonna call, say that's some predictor, you know, maybe it's a classifier, maybe it's a regression problem, for the moment it doesn't matter. I'm just gonna call it FD to mean that I'm gonna try to predict something based on X, and I've learned it from some data set that I'm gonna call D. So let's say I've learned this thing FD of X, and I wanna know how good it is. So as before, I'll define some loss function. So well, on this slide, I'm just calling it error. And I can get my training error. So I can average over all, I can take an expectation over all of the training data if I have n training points, and I'm gonna take the average value of the error on that training point. So I'll just say what's my prediction on xi, and I'll take the error correspond to yi. So for example, if I were doing regression, then my predictor would be take these learned parameters w, and I'll just linearly combine them with x, or with my basis expansion of x. So that's going to be my prediction, and then my error could be, move this out of the way, and my error could be squared error. So that would be the specialization of this for linear regression, but you could use the same notation for classifiers as well. So y could be a class label rather than rather than a real valued output, and in that case, error would be something that was like 0 or 1. You know, did I get the right label or did I not? So this is my error on the training set. So what am I trying to estimate when I measure the error on the training set? Because really, you don't care at all what the error in the training set is, right? Because I mean, I could have a classifier that just memorizes the training set, get perfect error, perfect training error. What you really care about is whether this predictor generalizes to new examples. So we're going to define that as the generalization error. And that's going to have this form of a population expectation. So this was kind of a sample expectation. I was taking the average of this value over a sample of data. Well, here what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the average. This average is going to be an integral now. It's going to be an average with respect to whatever the true distribution over the inputs and the outputs were. So for the purposes of this slide, I'll assume that y and x are distributed according to some distribution. And I'll imagine, you can think of this as if I had an infinite sample that was distributed according to p, what would my average over the error be? So this covers, this integral covers inputs that I have seen in the training data and also inputs that I haven't seen. So, and I want to know what my average error is over the whole population. So that's what we're going to call generalization error. And what I really want is a predictor FD that does really well in terms of generalization error. I wasn't expecting that transition, I don't know. So the problem is I can't go out and measure the generalization error, right? Because I can't collect, I'd have to collect every possible training point in order to measure this. So I could say, well, I want to estimate that somehow. Okay, so how can I do that? Well, if I look at the training set, well, that's a sample of points from this distribution. So I could take the training error, and I could try to take that as an estimate of the generalization error. But that's not such a good idea. Do you know why? Yeah, how did I get this training error from? How did I get FD, right? I picked an FD exactly to minimize this training error, right? So what that means is because I specifically looked for a model that would minimize this thing, if I change these endpoint points a little bit, the model might not do so well. So typically, the generalization error is going to be, usually it's a lot higher than the training error. So we'd like a better way to estimate the generalization error rather than looking at the training error. So this example I just showed you is an example of this. So what's happening here, let me describe what's happening here a little bit more abstractly. I started with an extremely simple model, a model that was hardly able to learn anything about the training data. That model both had very high training error, and it also had very high generalization error. And when I got over here, I made the model really, really complex. That model had really low training error because it memorized all the training points, but it has really high generalization error. So what I want to do is I want to pick something in the middle. I want to pick something that's going to have maybe a bit worse training error than this, but also better generalization error. So the reason that overfitting comes about is if I'm using a model that's too complex for the amount of data that I have. So the key thing that I want to do is I want some way to control how flexible or how complex the set of possible models I have is. So if I have a model family that's too simple, for example, just taking m equals 0, then it won't be able to, then the family, so when I talk about model family, what I really mean is, in this example, I mean the set of all possible red lines that I could get. So if you think of, for all w, it's going to be a set of functions, and it's going to be a set for all possible w, I'll get a different prediction function. And I want to think about how large that set is. So if I take a really simple model, so say just take m equals 0, then that family can't represent the actual patterns that are there. So we're going to talk about that as being underfitting. It actually can't learn the data at all. Whereas if the model is too complex, well, that's just as bad, because then you're overfitting. You're just going to remember noise or patterns in the data that occur only due to chance. So to say that more formally, if I've got some kind of predictor here, it overfits the data if there was some other predictor that had worse training error but better generalization error. So that's what this says here in a slightly reversing things. So if the predictor I picked, there's one that's worse on the training set but better overall on the generalization error, then I've overfit. And I probably always overfit to some extent, but I want to overfit not too bad. So what I really want is a balance between being too simple and underfitting and between being too complex. So how do I pick that balance? So here's another way to see this. This is just a graphical version of what I said in the previous slide. So if this is some kind of abstract axis that measures how complex the model is, so for example, m in that polynomial example, models that are more complex are more flexible, but they're also more likely to overfit. A really complex model is going to get very low training error, but really high generalization error on a test set. So we want to find some place that's kind of in here. So how are we going to do that? So what we really need is a knob, right? So what we need our learning algorithm to have is some parameter that causes the algorithm to favor either simpler rules or more complex rules, depending on how we set that parameter. And the value we're going to choose for that is going to depend on the problem. It's going to depend on the data. So that's why if you right-click on an algorithm in Weka, it always brings up some panel that has a bunch of parameters that you may or may not understand, right? The reason why it has that is because of overfitting, right? There's no one best way to make this balance between underfitting and overfitting. So you need to have the flexibility of setting a knob to say how complex a model do I want to end up with. So what we need for this is, for one, we need the algorithm to have a knob. That's A. The second thing we need is a way to set this knob, right? Because somehow, you're not going to pick it out of thin air. You need some way to set this based on data that doesn't overfit in itself. So for example, for decision trees, remember in decision trees we saw that lots of times a tree with a lot of nodes can represent a more complex relationship than a tree that only has a few nodes. So the way that decision tree algorithms handle overfitting is they grow a really big tree that maybe really memorizes the training data, and then they prune off nodes towards the leaves in order to make the tree simpler. So the parameters of this pruning procedure, that's the knob for a decision tree. For polynomial regression, the knob was M. By changing the highest order, changing the order of the polynomial, we could make the set of models that it would consider either simpler or more complex. Now for k nearest neighbor, what's the knob? Yeah, it's K. There's a hint. It's actually in the name. So which way makes it simpler? Big K or small K? Small K, right? Because if K was like, wait. No, to say that it's small K, why? Yeah. Yeah, right? If I have small K, what's the decision boundary going to look like between one class and the other? So if I have, another excuse to use the chalk. Oh, let me do this. Okay. Oh, and I can see. Right? So if I have, let's see, minus, plus, right? So what big K, so what say I took K equals 1, right? Then what it's going to do is it's going to say something like this. Right? It's going to draw a line like this between the examples, depending on whether this guy is closest or this guy is closest. Whereas if I have, on the other hand, say I had K equals 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Say I had K equals 9. Then what is it going to do? Yeah? Yeah, it's always going to predict. If I say K equals 9, then everything's going to be a neighbor. So it's always going to predict plus. So that's a lot simpler than doing this. Right? So in general, actually, big K gives you a simpler decision boundary than small K. So you want to look at the more wiggly this is, the more complex it is. And the knob, but what if, suppose I just had linear regression. So there should be a knob for that. But it's not, I haven't told you what it is yet. So that's what I'm going to do next. What? Yeah, so if I add more features, so if I had a basis expansion, I could make it more complex or less complex by changing the number of features in the basis expansion. But it turns out, even if I just make it be linear, so if I just say phi of x equals x, there's a way to, so from what I've told you so far, there's no knob in linear regression if I don't let you change the basis expansion. So now let's talk about a way to add a knob into linear regression. So this is going to be called regularization. So regularization is kind of a general approach to adding a knob to a learning algorithm. And it's going to be a continuous valued knob as opposed to these kind of discrete knobs that we've seen so far. So we can do this, and it's pretty much, do I actually believe that? Yeah, no, I think it's pretty much. So it's easier to use in cases where the parameters are continuous. Like we're going to see how to do it for regression. I don't see how to do this for decision trees. So the idea behind regularization is, if I go back and I look at, say, one of these wiggly polynomials here, where's my thing? So if I look at this really wiggly polynomial, not only does it have a high order, m equals 9, but if we actually went and looked at the weights, they'd be really big too. Whereas if I took, even if I had m equals 9, but I had really small weights, so maybe I had 0 in everything except the first order term, well, then I'd have something that looks like this. That's not as complicated. So what we're going to do in regularization is we're going to say, we'll let you use a big number of features. So we'll let you use m equals 9 or something, but you're going to have to pay a penalty for making the weights on those features be big. So that's what we're going to do here. So what I'm going to do for regression is I'm going to start with a squared error, which is this normal thing that my old friend that I already have. And I'm going to add an extra term. What that extra term is going to do is it's going to penalize large values of the weights. So what this thing here is the norm of the weights squared. So it's the sum over all I of wi. Sum over all I of wi squared. So that's going to be this thing. I'm going to try to minimize this. So what that means is that the higher, the larger the values of the weights are, the bigger this thing's going to be. Now I add the knob. So the knob is lambda. So if I set lambda equals 0, then this term's going to go away, and I'm just doing squared error. Whereas if lambda has to be positive, I should say that. If I make lambda really, really big, then this term is going to dominate this term. And it's going to stop trying to fit the data, and it's just going to try to make the weights really, really small, which is probably not what you want. So there's a method called ridge regression in statistics. And what that is quadratically regularized linear regression. So I take this and I minimize it. That's called ridge regression. So it turns out that you can actually minimize, it turns out you can actually minimize this thing analytically in the same way that we've done for all of the other regression variants that we've seen so far. And you get an answer that looks pretty much like what we've seen before, that we get this phi transpose phi inverse phi transpose. But now we add in this lambda times the identity matrix, and that comes from the ridge regression term. And basically that's the answer. So let's look at what this does kind of more graphically. So, you know, remember we said that this cost function for doing least squares is quadratic. So what that means, so what this is this is weight one, this is weight two, and what these circles are is kind of like a topographic map, right? So each of these are level sets of the objective function. So yeah, think of this like looking at some kind of, well, topographic map, like a map when you're going hiking. So these things are bigger, and this is the minimum. So this part here is going to be the least squares part of the loss function. So if I just had least squares, I would have this quadratic bowl coming up from the screen, and my minimum would be that blue dot. Now, this penalty term is quadratic, so it's going to be this quadratic bowl starting here. If I add together two quadratic functions, I get another quadratic function. So the overall cost function is going to be some other quadratic bowl whose center is going to be in between the centers of these two. Maybe it'll be here. And so it turns out, actually showing this mathematically is a little bit advanced, but it turns out that the minimum is actually going to be on this line of the sum. And that's just because of what happens when I add two quadratic functions. So what that means is the effect of the regularizer is, you know, as you might have thought by looking at this, but if you look at it geometrically, you see the effect of the regularizer is actually to shrink the weights. And so here's what happens if you apply regularization to this example we saw before. So this is, can you see this? No, where's lambda? No, it's not on this. So this is what we had if we had this example and we used m equals 9. So we got this really, really, really crazy fit. So it turns out if you set lambda, so this thing, it might be hard to see. This says natural log of lambda equals minus 18. So if I set lambda to something that's kind of small, but not zero, then so this is lambda equals zero. This is lambda equals e to the minus 18. So something pretty small, that's enough to prevent it from doing this crazy thing. So now I get some fit like this. Still m equals 9, but it's now I've added regularization. Now if I set lambda really, really big, so if I make it something close to infinity, then I'll just get something like this. I'm not allowed to move the weights at all, so I'll just get something where it always predicts zero. So what you want to do is find a midpoint in lambda. And you get the same kind of, so, and what you can do is actually you can look at the scope of all lambda. So this is lambda in log scale, and this is error. This is the square root of mean squared error. And I can do this on the training set, or I can do this on the test set. And what happens is I get the same kind of curve that if I have, as I had before, where is if I make the log of lambda go to negative infinity, so that's like having lambda equal zero. So I really overfit. I get zero training error and a really big test error. If I make, on the other hand, if I go to the other extreme, then I have this really simple model. So these two things are, so then log of lambda is getting close to zero, so lambda is getting really, really big, and I'm getting this thing where the error is going up, and somewhere in between is where I get the best test error. Okay, so now I want to go back to this kind of framework that we had for thinking about all learning algorithms, which is that there was some task it was trying to solve, and to solve that, I picked some class of possible predictors, that's the model structure, and then I had a score function to say how good a particular predictor was, and then I had a method for finding something that maximized the score function. So in the previous lecture, we just talked about using squared error as the scored function. But now with ridge regression, we have something different. We're still trying to solve regression. We're still using linear regression model. We're still optimizing it by an analytic solution, but now we have a squared error with quadratic regularization. So this is an example where we have the same model, but two different score functions for choosing the best parameter estimate of that model. And this is the first time in this course that we have seen that happen, but that's why it's so important to make that distinction between the model family and the fitting procedure. Okay, so now we've talked about a lot of different ways to add knobs to learning algorithms. So regularization was one way of adding kind of another term for the complexity of a classifier is called capacity. So you could think of, so regularization is a way of adding a knob for capacity control of a classifier. But how do we set lambda? Okay, so that's, right? It's not gonna work to do that on the training set because the, you know, if I pick lambda to minimize the training error, then I'm just gonna set lambda equals zero because that's gonna maximize the training error. So we need a different way to do it. We're gonna talk about two different ways of doing that. The first one is to use a validation set, and the second one is to use cross-validation. So what a validation set is instead of, so at some point, how did I get the training set and the test set? So what I did was somebody gave me a big batch of labeled data, usually, and then I decided, then I, as I'm training this algorithm, decided to split it into a training set and into a test set. So when I'm using a validation set, I just split it three ways instead of splitting it two ways. And then the third part is called the validation set. So what the training set is for, as you might think, just as before, we use that to train the algorithm. What the test set is for down here is once we're done, I want to know how well I can expect it to perform. So that's what the test set is for. If I tune any parameters of the algorithm on the test set, then the answer I get is going to be overfit. It's not going to tell me how the final model performs. So I have to put the test set off to the side and not touch it at all until I'm done. So, and now this third thing is the validation set. What I'm going to use the validation set for is I'm going to use it for tuning the knobs. So I'll use it to pick lambda. And there's no right answer about how to split this. You know, I'd say 60-20-20 is common, but depending on the problem, you could choose to do it a different way. So I wasn't very good at making sure this didn't get cut off. I apologize. But in polynomial regression, for example, what you would do is you try each value of m up to some maximum. You just loop over all of these m's. For each possible m, you can train it. You train on the training set using this m, and you measure the error on the validation set. And then you're going to choose the one that has the best error on the validation set. And then if you want to know how well this thing performs, then you use the test set. If you want, once you've chosen the best m, you could go back, put the validation set back into the training set, and then train on, say, 80% of the data rather than 60%. If you think that'll really help you, you could do that too. But that's after you've chosen m. Okay, so I think that's pretty much all the time. Let's see, what's this? Cross-validation, yeah. So that's pretty much all. I think I'll stop here, because we're almost done. Next time we'll talk about cross-validation.
Different values of lambda. Logarithms of lambda.
Yep.
Here, the one before. This one. This is lambda equal to one, right? The diagram is correct, not because.
Lambda equals one. Yeah.
No, yeah, because now it makes sense. It's not a straight line as it would be.
Yeah, that's right. It is a little bit. Sorry. Yeah.
For performance in data warehouses and warehouse-scale computers.
Okay.
I think it's called Dynamine. And I was thinking of choosing that paper to do my research.
Yes.
And I would like to ask you how much overlap you have with distributed systems and how much you have to get into...
So for the Dynamine paper, I think that's more about kind of like learning the patterns of a library. So you wouldn't have to, if it's that paper, it wouldn't necessarily be an overlap with distributed systems.
Because it has applied to distributed systems.
You could apply it to distributed systems, that's right.
I think the paper was about that. To model performance in
I'm thinking of a different paper then. There was one
depends. Do you remember the title and the authors? I forget, because I uploaded like 6 or 7 papers, so I don't remember. And some of them, because if it's the one about performance, then yeah, it was about modeling the performance of distributed systems.
Yeah,
I forget exactly.
I think Dynamine
is something different, but I don't remember. It could be.
Okay, if in the case, I'll tell you that it's model the performance of warehouse scale computers, something like that.
Yeah.
That was the topic that you had posted.
Yeah.
Modeling performance in the, okay?
Yeah.
Do you think that I should get into more distributed systems than machine learning or the other?
It's kind of applying machine, it's kind of some of, it's probably more machine learning, I would think. But it's some of both.
You know, because I only want to get into distributed systems more than machine learning, because my specialization is machine learning, so.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of papers like that, which is kind of like, you know, you use some kind of high level information about the structure of the distributed system in order to do better prediction. So, you know, so how much distributed systems is it? It's hard to say. I mean, you get some, I mean, it's not like, I mean, it does use the fact that the system is distributed to build a model. So it's not completely treating the system as a black box, but it's not.
But the survey should be more machine learning algorithms that could be applied to.
Oh, you're going to rip it. You could do it. You could twist it. I mean, it depends on what you want to do, right? It's kind of your option, kind of which emphasis you want to put on it. I mean, I can say there are a number of papers. I mean, there are some papers that are just kind of applying off-the-shelf algorithms and not even really using the fact that they're distributed. And then there's some papers that are kind of using some of the structure of the system.
Yes,
in order
to exploit some features of the system. So.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question at all, but yeah.
I have a quote. I have one question about this.
Okay, that's fine. So what is your question? Your question is what other papers should you look at, or?
Yeah, I'm talking to the paper. I'm trying to see the relevant papers of this one.
Yeah.
And there's only the relevant papers are more on machine learning or more on distributed systems.
Oh, I see. I would look for other papers by the same authors, and I would also look at this set of workshops called Systems and Machine Learning, so like SysML or MLSys. And you could also look for, there's this guy, Peter Bodick, who he might be one of the authors of that paper. I would look for other, his dissertation will contain a lot of references in this area. So you could look at the related work section of his dissertation.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, good.
Your bug's over.
Oh, thanks. I have to put this in here. Okay, so what's your question about this?
The question is, when we're considering about using polynomial to fit in this graph, we actually noticed that this polynomial family is not orthogonal. We should use Chebyshev in order. Chebyshev polynomials. We may kind of avoid this to overfitting problem.
I don't know. Let's go outside. I don't know.
The question is.
Oh, that's fine. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So I don't know the formula for those offhand, but you're not.